Sounds True presents Robert Anton Wilson Explains Everything, or Old Bob Exposes His Ignorance. For almost 40 years, Robert Anton Wilson has been at the forefront of consciousness research, both as a doctor of psychology and as a psychedelic pioneer. He's the author of over 30 works, including screenplays, novels, and books on psychology, social philosophy, sexuality, and practical magic. As the millennium came to a close, we brought the psychologist, teacher, engineer, and novelist together with Sounds True's editorial director, Michael Taft, to explore Dr. Wilson's favorite subjects, including conspiracy theory, language and general semantics, consciousness and consciousness change. In addition, we have included three classic lectures that explore central themes in the work of Robert Anton Wilson: the rapid acceleration of knowledge, the absurdities of religious practices through the ages, and the current climate of fundamental materialism, which he calls the New Inquisition. In our first session, Michael Taft takes Wilson back to his childhood years in the Irish ghetto of New York City, in the middle of the Great Depression.
I was born in a hospital in Flatbush and raised in a part of Long Island called Garrison Beach, which was just a bunch of cottages or cabins or cabanas or bungalows. The first serious book I ever read when I was about 13 or 14 was Studs Lonergan by James T. Farrell, because older boys told me it had a lot of hot sex scenes in it. And at 13 and 14, I was very eager to acquire some sex education, and there didn't seem to be anywhere to get it except from novels. I didn't know pornography existed or how to obtain any, and I certainly couldn't get any straight answers from any of the adults I knew. So I read Studs Lonergan. I was astonished. This is about a working-class Irish Catholic ghetto in Chicago, and it was just like my own upbringing in Brooklyn. The working-class Irish Catholics are pretty much the same everywhere. Later, I read A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce, and by God, it was the same story all over again.
So can you describe what life was like at Garrison Beach in those days?
Well, we didn't know any Protestants. We heard rumors that people called Jews existed somewhere, but that was across the river in Manhattan. We didn't know there were any in Brooklyn. There was the biggest depression in the history of the Western world, in both Europe and the United States. There were millions of people unemployed everywhere. There were people selling apples on street corners to make a living.
Do you remember what you wanted to be when you were growing up?
Well, I think the first ambition I ever had was to be a cartoonist. And that ambition ran from about the age of 4 or 5 until I was 7 or 8. Then I discovered there were books without pictures. And I figured, hell, it's easier to write the stories if I don't have to do the pictures, too. So then my ambition turned to become a writer of books.
And that was at what age?
Oh, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, somewhere around there.
How did your family react to that ambition?
They thought I was batshit crazy. My mother and father told me repeatedly, writers all starve to death unless you got the right contacts, and you don't have the right contacts, so think of a job where you can make some money.
So for you, it was kind of a pipe dream at that point?
Well, I wrote my first novel at the age of 12.
What was the name of it?
It was called The Age of Miracles, and it was intended to be adapted into a musical comedy starring Danny Kaye after it was a bestseller as a novel. Of course, it never got anywhere. Who can write a novel at the age of 12?
Do you remember people in your environment there, besides your parents, of course, that strongly affected your thinking?
Well, the good nuns at the school I went to terrorized the hell out of me with visions of hell and damnation and all sorts of horrors. But that's typical of Roman Catholic education. I mean, you find it in Studs Lonergan and A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Any novel about a Catholic upbringing, you find similar stories. Catholic education is based on brute terrorism. When they're not scaring you psychologically, they're scaring you physically. The nuns had these steel yardsticks, and if you did something they didn't like, you'd be called up to the front of the classroom and told to hold your hand out. I never saw anybody refuse to hold their hand out because we all had this deep-seated suspicion that if we didn't hold our hand out, something even worse would happen. So we'd put our hand out, and then they'd whack us across the knuckles with the yardstick about five times. Sometimes it hurt for a day and a half. That sort of created an atmosphere of respectful attention and discouraged dissent.
What was a typical offense for which one would receive such punishment?
Not having your hair combed properly, questioning something one of the nuns said, arguing with a nun, saying you liked the movie that the church said you shouldn't have gone to see.
Do you feel like you received anything worthwhile there?
Yeah, very definitely. They taught me to read and write and do arithmetic and learn a little bit of geography and history. And by and large, I think they do a fairly good job on the educational front. If they would only leave out all the sadomasochism, it might be one of the best educational systems in the world. James Joyce thought he acquired a great deal from the Jesuits, even though in The Portrait of the Artist he portrays the sadistic side of it very brutally and frankly.
So they gave you a pretty decent basic education?
I would say so, yeah.
How about other folks around there? Were there particular characters or people that you remember really affecting your...
There was hardly anybody until I got to high school. There was hardly anybody I could talk to.
Why is that?
Well, because I got some weird combination of genes and imprints that made me a bit weird or a bit of a maverick. And I learned to keep my mouth shut. If the nuns weren't going to hit me with the yardstick, the other boys were going to get in a gang and beat me up for something I said. So I learned to keep my mouth shut until I got to Brooklyn Technical High School, where I met a whole bunch of people who weren't Irish Catholics, and you could say anything you wanted and nobody would beat you up for it. As a matter of fact, the teachers encouraged us to think.
Now, how is it that you as an aspiring writer ended up at Brooklyn Technical College?
Well, I had to find some excuse not to go to a Catholic high school. I heard that the Catholic high schools were run by brothers and they were even worse than the sisters. The sisters only hit you with yardsticks, the brothers would beat you up with their fists. And as a matter of fact, that report has been confirmed from numerous sources, including Ireland, where I lived for 6 years. Anyway, I didn't want to fall into the hands of the brothers and get beaten up with their fists. I figured the yardsticks were enough punishment, so I decided I was going to become an engineer because everybody told me I couldn't be a writer. And I felt that I had a certain talent for engineering. It took a long time to disillusion me with that idea.
How did you get that idea?
I had a talent for mathematics and for physics. I tend to think in quasi-mathematical and geometrical. I tend to think in terms of forces and actions and reactions, and I'm fascinated by isomorphisms, systems that are similar in structure. And that's what a lot of science is about, is finding isomorphisms. And so I thought I could make it as an engineer. And I gradually discovered that as Sam Hayakawa, a former senator, once a teacher of general semantics, one of his books, he points out that some people are better at symbol manipulation and some people are better at thing manipulation. I'm much better at symbol manipulation. When something goes wrong with an appliance, I call a repairman instead of trying to repair it myself. That is not the ideal personality for an engineer. So I decided to go into pure mathematics, so I didn't know how I was going to make a living from that, but I thought I'd get an advanced degree and teach pure mathematics. But meanwhile, I still wanted to be a writer, and I was still writing.
So you had continued writing after the failure of The Age of Miracles?
Oh, yeah, I wrote, in my high school days, I wrote quite a few short stories, which I sent to such sterling publications as Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Amazing Stories, and Weird Tales. And they all came back. The worst disillusionment of all was when a story I sent to Weird Tales came back with a rejection slip from Thrilling Western Tales. I never did figure that out. But it suddenly gave me a vision of how much attention they paid to unsolicited manuscripts by unknown authors.
Were you still doing that in technical school?
Yeah, but when I got into a Brooklyn Polytech, which is a college level, I was working days, going to night school, and they pile the homework on you even though they know you're working days. I didn't write much in those years.
Mm. What kind of work were you doing?
I was an engineering aide at a big engineering firm, and that meant I did all the, what nowadays we call shit work, that the engineers themselves didn't want to be bothered with. I made graphs out of the data they obtained in the field. I wrote abstracts of articles that might interest the electrical engineering department and circulated them to all the engineers so they could read my abstract and decide whether they wanted to read the whole article or not. I assisted in experiments on corrosion in the corrosion laboratory, which I suppose was the beginning of my interest in Buddhism. I suddenly began to realize all things are impermanent. Metals corrode, organisms die, everything is in a process of continuous change, and trying to stop corrosion is impossible. The aim of corrosion engineering is not to stop corrosion, but to slow it down so that whatever metal thing you're trying to protect will last as long as possible. You don't expect it to last forever. Corrosion and rust are anaerobic bacteria. Something will get it eventually. So corrosion engineering is the art of the possible, how to slow down the decay process.
So how many years were you, like, directly doing engineering or studying engineering?
7 years. And it left me with, a suspicion toward all theories that can't be demonstrated with working models. I don't like abstractions much. I don't like abstract theories much. I don't know. I don't exactly disagree with them. They just don't get me interested. I'm like, well, so what? I feel about ideology like John Adams, our second president, who said ideology had a couple of syllables too many. It should be just called idiocy.
So you like stuff that can either be demonstrated or be used in some useful way?
Yes, very much so.
And what about when you left the engineering world? Where did you flee?
I did all sorts of things. I wrote advertising copy for 2 years. I distributed samples door-to-door for Procter & Gamble for a couple of weeks once. I worked as an ambulance attendant for about 6 months.
What kind of experiences did you have there?
Oh, that was very educational. I was working in Spanish Harlem. I got to see a great deal of the aspects of New York life that are now very popular on TV, on shows like Law and Order and NYPD Blue. I got to see it up close. The cops could see how young I was for an ambulance attendant. So they would arrange to make sure I saw the most gruesome case up close just to see how I'd react.
So going back to your early childhood for a minute, what's your most vivid memory of that time?
King Kong and Frankenstein and the Wolfman, the Devil and Daniel Webster, the Thief of Baghdad, and any movie that showed things that were impossible fascinated me. I want to know how they did them. And also, despite my aversion to abstractions, I have no aversion whatsoever to fantasy. I regard fantasy as a special kind of language.
What kind of language?
A poetic language. I think Frankenstein and the Wolfman are among the most poetic movies ever made.
So you feel that the poetic language of fantasy talks to us in Jungian type terms, or?
Jung is one good source to try to understand. I don't think Jung explains fully. I don't think anybody understands fully the power of poetry and fantasy. I think they come from a level of the psyche or to be more modern about it, the nervous system. They come from some level of the brain, the nervous system, the neuroendocrine system. They come from somewhere deep inside that you never create them, you just let them run rampant and they come out of your fingers and onto the paper.
So when you were a child, you felt just the raw power of the imagery and were excited by it?
Yeah, I didn't know the word allegory, I didn't know the word parable, I didn't know the word unconscious, I'd never heard of Carl Jung. But my favorite movies all opened up those kind of vistas. Every now and then I'd see a realistic film I liked, but it was always it always had something off kilter about it, like The Maltese Falcon, where instead of the hero and heroine kissing at the end, he turns her over to the cops. And the Falcon turns out to be fake. Every John Huston film has this theme of the impossible goal which you almost achieve and then you lose it. It's as persistent in John Huston as the mysterious stranger who doles out justice and injustice equally and then disappears, reappears over and over in Clint Eastwood's films. Some writers get hung up on a particular archetype and do directors and do it over and over.
Do you feel as a writer you have a particular archetype?
I seem to have more than one. The underground journey seems to appear in all of my novels in one form or another. Not always Dante's form of it, but one form or another of underground journey. Also the theme of the elderly shaman teaching the younger one how to become a shaman. I didn't get that from Carlos Castaneda. I was writing that type of thing before I ever heard of Carlos Castaneda. It's just a theme that I resonate with.
Was there anyone in your environment in any way that like influenced you to become a writer, you know, indirectly?
Just the writers I read. Nobody in my environment.
Early on, did you have anything that we would call like spiritual experiences?
Yeah, movies like the ones I mentioned. I didn't know they were spiritual experiences, but in retrospect, I think they were. The biggest disappointment of my childhood was my first Holy Communion. According to the teaching of the church, and I hope I don't misquote, I've been out of the church so long, I may not have the dogma exactly correct, but I think I understood that one pretty well. After the priest says the magic formula over the piece of bread, it is no longer a piece of bread. It has become not only the body, but also the blood of Jesus Christ. And so if you eat the body and blood of this Jew who's been dead for 2,000 years, it'll make you feel real good and you'll have a spiritual experience. And the idea of cannibalism as a spiritual experience was really unique to the Catholic Church before Hannibal Lecter came along and popularized the idea. But I remember how excited I was looking forward to my first Holy Communion. I took the wafer and nothing happened. There was no spiritual experience. Nothing happened at all. I just had a piece of dry bread in my mouth. Not very tasty bread either. Worse than Wonder Bread. Nothing. That was when I first began to suspect the church was an enormous con game. I had my first experience of real Holy Communion when I first took peyote in 1962. That's what they were faking. This is the real stuff.
Did you resonate at all with the archetypes of Jesus and Mary or anything like that?
Well, Mary must have had some effect on me. When I had polio, my mother did a novena to the Blessed Virgin and dressed me in blue for a year.
What's a novena?
That's a ceremony done for 9 weeks. That's where the novus root comes in, novus nine. It's related to the nightmare and her ninefold in King Lear and the nine muses in Greek mythology and so on. Nine is the number of the moon. It's used in all sorts of magical workings. Of course, the Pope wouldn't want to admit that.
So you mentioned that you had polio.
Yes, I sure did. No doubt about it. I don't remember much about the polio. I'm remembering more lately. I had polio at the age of 4. At that time, the American Medical Association said there was no cure for it. There was a crazy nurse in Australia named Sister Kenny who claimed she had a cure. And by some odd stroke of blind luck or divine guidance or something, my parents found the one doctor in the greater New York area who was using the Sister Kenny method. And I was apparently totally cured. And I spent most of my life walking around, running, doing everything that ordinary people do. And then in my 20s, I started to have spasms in the legs, which kept me awake at night until I found a doctor who prescribed Valium for it. Valium was originally a muscle relaxant before they started selling it as a tranquilizer. It's very good for post-polio syndromes. And that bothered me for 20 years or so off and on, but the Valium controlled it. And then I started getting leg pains. And I found out after trying a variety of doctors and a variety of medicines that ibuprofen worked about as well as anything. And then suddenly this April, the leg pains became worse than ever, and I started falling down, and now I'm on a variety of medications, and I'm back where I, almost where I was at the age of four, but doing much better. I'm recovering faster this time, I think. Well, I'm a congenital optimist. I think it comes with the genes.
Do you think that the early experience of polio had much effect on you?
Yeah, I think it underlies the tone of anxiety and paranoia that you find in all of my novels. Basically, all the characters in my novels come to a point where they're convinced the universe has been organized just to destroy them.
Well, that's just obviously true.
No, sorry. No, it hasn't been organized to destroy you. It's been organized to destroy all of us. But you get this feeling that the whole universe is an enormous conspiracy to destroy you. I think that comes with any disease like polio or the fatal diseases like cancer and so on. I had a lot of friends die of cancer in the last 10 years. And I think polio gave me a deep sense that the universe can't be trusted, that life is not a bowl of cherries, and that you got to be pretty damn tough to survive. And then I read Nietzsche when I was about 18, and he gave me all the philosophy I needed to back up that general idea. The universe doesn't give a damn for you. There is no God. The universe doesn't care. You're on your own, brother, and learn to live with it. Anything that doesn't kill me makes me stronger. That's my favorite quote from Nietzsche. And anything that doesn't kill me makes me stronger.
So did you spend very much time, like, actually in your room, unable to go out?
Yeah, I think that was about a year. What I remember best is when I was in recovery, one of the things, besides the hot cloths, which are a standard part of the Sister Kenny method, and the baths and the exercising the legs, there was a period in which I was in recovery, and I was supposed to walk all the time with one leg in the gutter and one leg on the sidewalk, and switch legs regularly, side to side of the sidewalk. This was where there wasn't very heavy traffic. It was safe for a kid to do it, where we were living. And this was supposed to stretch each leg and make the muscle stronger. I don't know how many dead muscles I've got in my legs. It's an interesting question. I've been researching post-polio syndrome on the World Wide Web, and I find the estimates run as high as 50% of the muscles die during polio. So what the hell have I been walking on for the last 64 years? On faith and willpower, mostly. But that wears out after 60 years. The muscles just started complaining too much. But I still walk a little bit every day, just to prove I can and to keep in practice. I figured if I learn to walk twice, I can learn to walk three times. I remember somebody telling me about a guy starting a new computer company and how optimistic he was. And I said, well, pessimists don't start computer companies or any other kind of companies. The pessimists never do a damn thing but sit and bitch and moan and piss and complain. The optimists do everything. So I'm on the side of the optimists. I think the universe is indifferent, but I'm still an optimist.
What drugs were popular in the Garrison Beach community?
A hemp rope. I don't know how old I was, 6, 7, 8, I don't know. But at some point, a bunch of older boys were sitting behind the coal bin in the yard of somebody's house and smoking rope. And I said, what's that? And they say, it makes you feel great. So I sat down and smoked some rope with them. And we did that pretty regularly for a year or so. And then suddenly the rope lost its effect. And it didn't get us high and happy anymore. And then I forgot all about that until I started researching the history of marijuana. That was when they stopped making hemp rope in this country, and they replaced it with various synthetics and plastics. So we were damn lucky that the plastic they replaced it with wasn't poisonous, because we would have taken a great big toke and all dropped dead. And our parents would find 8 dead kids with a mystery. What killed them? I'm glad that didn't happen.
How does one smoke a hemp rope?
You just light one end of it and suck as hard as you can on the other.
So you cut off a cigarette length of rope? And
We used a longer length than that because we passed it around. Another great spiritual experience of my childhood besides the hemp rope was spinning until you get dizzy and fall down. All cultures seem to figure that out or learn it from older kids or something. It seems to be almost universal. Those and the movies I mentioned were the essence of my quote, unquote, spiritual life. The Catholic Church did nothing but scare the shit out of me. They didn't give me any spiritual nourishment whatsoever. I'm not, I don't mean to sound bitter against the Catholic Church. I don't think it's the worst church in the world. I think it's one of the three worst, but not the worst. I haven't decided which is the worst, the Catholic Church, Islam, or Scientology. But those are definitely the three most poisonous of the lot. I don't like churches in general, though. I think they're all pretty dreadful. Well, maybe some parts of Buddhism aren't so dreadful. I was married in a Buddhist church.
Where was that?
In New York City. Arlen and I were talking about where we were going to get married, and we both didn't want anything to do with the church. And I suddenly said, I don't like City Hall either. And she said, what do you want to do, go up on a mountain and do our own ritual? I said, let's find a Buddhist church. She said, I like that. So we found a Buddhist church. It was Shinran Buddhist, and it was a really lovely ceremony. And it worked. We loved each other 42 years.
What did you do when you got out of college?
I never got out of college, so to speak. I worked for an engineering firm and went to college at nights. And then after that, I decided to launch my career as a writer, which landed me in a variety of jobs as editor of totally forgotten magazines, reporter for various newspapers, including one that's still quite successful that managed to survive my present, Home Furnishings Daily, which is read by everybody in the home furnishings business. And eventually I ended up with one of the most prestigious jobs you can have as an editor. I was associate editor of Playboy. Boy, did that impress people. Nothing I've done since has impressed people as much as that. And there were about 15 associate editors, so it wasn't that glorious a title, actually.
And how did you end up as an associate editor at Playboy?
Well, I was working for an imitation of Playboy called Jaguar. And the publisher told me to make it more like Playboy, and I made it more like Playboy, and he fired me because he couldn't understand it. Which is to say, I made it a magazine for college graduates, yuppies as they call nowadays, the upwardly mobile young males of the 60s. And I got another job on one of those tabloid newspapers. And while I was working at that job, I wrote an article about my experience putting out this imitation Playboy. And it was called Confessions of a Schlockmeister by Anonymous Hack. And it was published in The Realist. And one of the editors of Playboy read it and contacted the editor of The Realist, and I was called in for an interview. And then they sent me back to New York and sent me to a psychologist for a day of tests. That was right after Spektorsky took over as editorial director of Playboy. And Spektorsky was a big fan of psychological testing. So I went through all these tests. I had a barrel of fun with them because I was also being considered for a job as an editor of a social science journal in St. Louis. And I didn't see any reason to try to fool the psychologist anyway. I just let it rip. So I remember one of the thematic apperception cards is a guy on a table who may be in pain or may be laughing, depends on what you want to project into it, with two guys leaning over him with what may be knives or may be scalpels or maybe something else, depending on, and a guy looking in front of them, looking right out at you, who seems to have all of the standard characteristics we attribute to gay men. And you're supposed to project into that. So I projected into it. This is a scene from a horror movie. One of the actors has just blown his lines. The guy on the table is a survivor of a Nazi concentration camp, is thinking ironic thoughts about the public's appetite for artificial horrors in a world so full of real horrors. The gay guy up front is thinking the director is a pain in the ass. I don't know what they made out of that, but I answered them all that way. I just let my imagination rip, you know, and my sardonic sense of humor. I also took an IQ test, which had very interesting results. When I was talking to the psychologist after all the tests were over, I said, how did I do on the IQ? And he said, I'm not going to tell you, you're too conceited already. I've always thought of myself as a very modest person. Something must have come out in those tests that showed a great deal of vanity that I never liked to acknowledge. So I don't know how high my IQ is, but I know it's pretty high.
So you took those tests as a part of getting hired at Playboy?
That's right, yeah. And I went directly to work for the Playboy Forum, even though they originally thought of hiring me to write the Playmate of the Month copy. But I had lunch with the guy who was editing the Playboy Forum. He decided I would just write for that department. The Playboy Forum was letters from readers, about civil liberties issues together with Playboy's responses. I wrote most of Playboy's responses while I was there. Of course, they all had to be approved by Hefner. He would read the galleys of the whole damn magazine between midnight and 6 a.m. And we'd come back covered with blue corrections of all sorts, some of them running longer than the original text. But he hardly ever changed any of my copy. It seems, although we're very different types of human beings, Hefner and I think very much alike about political issues. Get the government off our backs. The less government, the better. Very Jeffersonian.
So during those years, what was the Playboy Forum like?
Well, I think we were the first mass magazine. There were a lot of radical little magazines in the 60s, you know. We were the first mass magazine to come out for legalizing marijuana. We were the first one to oppose the war in Vietnam among the mass magazines. We were the first to support legalizing abortion. We were the first to support gay rights. We were the first to support almost everything that's still controversial, even 30 years later, but less controversial than it was in the 60s. And I was real happy. I was writing my own opinions and getting the highest salary I ever earned in all of my business career. And then the feminists came along and told me I was a male chauvinist pig for working for Hefner. And I thought, what the hell is this? I got a job that I enjoy doing where I'm writing what I really think. I'm getting the biggest salary. Now they're trying to lay a guilt trip on me for it. I haven't liked feminists much since then, even though my wife was a feminist. But she felt that we needed the money, so she didn't object to my working for Playboy. She wasn't that kind of feminist anyway.
Why do you think that job stands out in people's minds as so prestigious?
I think there's a vast mythology about orgies at the Playboy Mansion. They imagine if you work there, you must have had orgies with the playmate, with several playmates of the month at once.
So can you describe for listeners one of these orgies you attended?
I never attended an orgy in the Playboy Mansion. I wasn't invited. If they were having orgies, they didn't invite me.
So how long did you work for Playboy?
About 6 years, a little less than 6 years.
But it was wasn't it during that time that you began working on your writing career as such?
Well, I'd always been writing. I've been published in dozens of magazines. One of the rules they had at Playboy was if you were a Playboy editor, you couldn't publish in another magazine under your own name without getting Spektorsky's approval, so that you wouldn't reflect unfavorably on Playboy's image. But they left that deliberate loophole under your own name, so you could write anything you want for any other magazine as long as it wasn't under the name that appeared on Playboy's masthead. So I invented about 7 pen names and was writing for all the underground newspapers of the 60s. There's where I was putting the opinions that were too radical for the Playboy Forum, like our presidents have been a series of serial killers.
When was your first book published?
That's fascinating. You asked me when my first book was published, and I can't remember. It was either 72 or 73. Yeah, either 72 or... I can remember when my first article was published. That was 1959. In 1959, I sold 2 articles on my birthday. One to the James Joyce Review, it was called Joyce and Taoism, and one to the Realist, which it was called The Semantics of God. The Semantics of God asked the question, does God have a penis? Which has become a hot topic in the last couple of decades. I think I was the first one to raise the issue. I asked, is God a he, a she, or an it, and came down in favor of it, as you might guess by the fact I also wrote an article about Joyce and Taoism at the same time. I'm very much into Taoism. I can conceive of a principle of organization within the universe that makes things work out in a certain way, but I can't conceive of a personality. The idea that there's a character, especially a character like Yahweh in the Old Testament, I just can't believe he had anything to do with it. If he existed at all, he couldn't create the universe. He couldn't even create a DNA molecule. He'd get about 2 strands right, then he'd get the third one wrong, then he'd get it Then you go into a tiff and blow up three cities and drop fire and brimstone on four more and tell the Hebrews to go slaughter another tribe. I mean, he's at a four-year-old level of mental development, and this is supposed to be the mind behind the universe. That's like asking me to believe that the Three Stooges created the universe.
And what was the first book that came out in 72 or 73?
Playboy's Book of Forbidden Words, which I am currently rewriting since the rights have reverted to me under the title Black Magic and Curses. And it's written from a more anthropological standpoint than the original. But it's mostly the same material, but it's with a more scholarly and anthropological way of looking. Or perhaps, sometimes I don't know whether I'm writing social science or social satire. Sometimes it's hard to tell even for me, even within one paragraph. But it's about why people are terrorized by words. George Carlin told me that he used that book as a reference for the routine where he gets up and recites all the different terms for some sex act. Have you ever seen him do that?
Yes.
Yeah, yodeling in the valley, going down to the wife for lunch, on and on and on. He got a whole bunch of them out of that book, he told me. Why are people so terrorized by words? It's a fascinating subject. Arlen told me once, I'm the most adaptable person she ever knew. And although she was in love with me and therefore prejudiced, had a higher opinion of me than I ever had of myself, I think she's right about the adaptability. I seem to have led a dozen different lives in one lifetime. I don't seem to have a very rigid personality structure. I went from being a Playboy editor to being a self-employed freelance writer, which resulted after a year of using up my savings, it resulted in 2 years on welfare, which I talk about quite commonly. Just because I sometimes engage in debates, and I can always tell if the other guy is an asshole if he brings that up in order to put me down. You know, then I know I'm dealing with a real asshole, and I know how to handle assholes. I've known them since I was a child, you know. And then my book started making enough money, and I got off welfare.
Were you still at Playboy when you started writing Illuminatus?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was still at Playboy when we finished Illuminatus. It just took 5 years to get it published. It just didn't fit into the Madison, Lexington Avenue reality tunnel where all the big publishers are. It took a long, long time. Shay and I never lost faith in it. We really believed we'd written a terrific book. But it took us 5 years to get it published anyway.
How did you finally end up getting it published?
Oh, somebody at Dell had the moxie to keep on pushing until his superiors agreed, okay, we'll give it a chance, but cut it up into three books, so it's not such a big risk.
Didn't you also have to remove like 500 pages?
Yeah, they wanted it to be shorter so the investment in paper would not be such a big financial risk. Those 500 pages got lost. When they made that decision, I was in Mexico, Shay was in Chicago, and Dell was in New York, and with the papers flying back and forth as we made the cuts, most of the cuts got lost. People keep asking me, will they ever be published? No. But some of them have been published in a sense, because some of them came back to my mind and got incorporated into another novel of mine called Schrödinger's Cat, which explains why some of the characters from Illuminatus reappear in Schrödinger's Cat. This is material that I remembered and recreated in Schrödinger's Cat.
Was it a pleasant experience to collaborate with Robert Shay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we never had the kind of feud that Gilbert and Sullivan had. Nothing remotely like that.
Did you rewrite each other's pieces?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He'd write a section, I'd rewrite it and add to it, and he'd rewrite the whole thing and add to that. That was our method. Other collaborators use other methods. That was our method.
So when you switched to full-time writing, did you have in your mind a whole series of books you wanted to write, or were you just trusting that there was enough material there in vestigial form?
I always felt from childhood on that I was supposed to write books. I don't know when I started my freelance career. I don't know how many books I had in my head that I thought I was going to write, and I don't know how many of them I ever got around to writing. A freelance writer's career is not entirely self-determined. If a publisher appears with a big check and says, can you write a book on this subject for this check, it turns out I can write a book on that subject, and it'll turn out sounding just like I thought of it myself by the time I'm through with it. The Book of the Breast for Playboy Press, which is now out under the title Ishtar Rising, that came about because they asked me, can you write a whole book about the female breast and keep it interesting? I said, sure I can. And I did. And it turns out to be a very interesting analysis of the rise and fall of goddess worship and how it relates to historical patterns in general. It lends itself to lots of illustrations of bare-breasted women, which is what Playboy Press wanted. But it sort of foreshadows a lot of interesting theories that came out of neo-Reichian psychology and feminism in the last 20 years or so. There's a book called Saharasia. It's written by a guy named James D. Mayo. He used the two largest computer data banks on customs of cultures around the world. And he found cultures tend to be with a 95% accuracy to follow one of two patterns, which he calls armored patrist and unarmored matrist. Well, in Ishtar Rising, I call them oral matrist and anal patrist, but they're basically the same categories. Only he did a hell of a lot more research than I did and proved his case a lot better than I did. But I find it absolutely amazing that just as an amateur anthropologist, I managed to get a certain axis of reference that does seem to have a certain validity. I see it being quoted more and more in various places, not always attributed to me. But then I didn't invent it entirely. I took part of it out of an English sociologist called Rattray Taylor, who wrote a book called Sex and History. He just divided them into matrist and patrist. I added the oral and anal to make it coincide with Freudian developmental theory, mm-hmm. and DeMeo added armored and unarmored to make it coincide with Reichian theory.
Isn't that book, Ishtar Rising, still in print?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's still selling quite well, thank you. That's it's been selling quite well for 28 years, I guess. Well, most of my books from the 70s are still in print. Matter of fact, all of my books from the 70s are in print. The only books that are out of print are three historical novels I wrote in the 80s.
When did you first feel like you were making it as a professional writer?
I've never quite achieved that state of mind. Because of the ups and downs of a freelance writer's life, I always have in the back of my head this ledger about how many months I've got before I'm broke unless I earn some more money. And when it's more than 12 months, I feel fairly secure. When it's less than 6 months, I start getting frightened. But it's never been less than 6 months in the last 3 or 4 years, or maybe the last 5 or 6 years, I don't know. I mean, it's never fallen really low, but I still have the habit of worry. That comes out of being a freelance writer. You never know where the next check is coming from. I'm worrying less about money than I ever did before, I'll say that.
Why is that?
Well, I don't have as many dependents as I used to have, for one thing, and for another thing, unless I lose all my popularity, whatever it is, and nobody buys any of my books, I can virtually live on the royalties of the books I got in print now. I can't live handsomely and extravagantly like a Hollywood star or any of that stuff. But I can live at a comfortable middle-class standard of living, which is all I ever required of life. I just want comfort. I don't need luxury. As long as I'm comfortable and I'm not worried about how I'm going to eat, I can concentrate on my writing. That's all I ask for, is that I'm not distracted by money worries and can concentrate on my writing. And it's taken me quite a while to realize I reached that stage probably about 10 years ago, but the habit of worry didn't go away immediately. It still hung on, and to some extent it still hangs on occasionally. Supposing everybody did stop buying Illuminata suddenly, that would be about $8,000 a year less. That's about how much I make out of that book every year. My God, $8,000 less. Then supposing everybody stopped buying Prometheus Rising, there's another $4,000 a year gone. Where would I be? So you can't stop worrying entirely. Not in this business. And if I had a bestseller and got rich, I'd be worrying about how to invest the money so that I... I think in this society, there's no way to avoid worrying about money.
You don't think there's any level you could get to, either high or low, where it just wouldn't matter?
Well, to get back to Hefner, I never got to know Hefner very well, but we did chat a few times, and I got the impression that Hefner was a lot more radical than the Playboy Forum. The Forum was radical for its time, but he was even further out. There were some things he didn't want to print, and I try to figure out, how can a guy with $100 million be afraid of taking a risk? And then I realized every time J. Paul Getty came to Chicago, he stayed at the Playboy Mansion as Hefner's guest, and he had $4 billion. And he realized, if you've only got $100 million, a guy with $4 billion really makes you feel like an ant, you know, so you're nervous. Until you get $4 billion, you don't feel quite equal to him, you know. At least that's my explanation of why people with millions and millions are still trying to get more. That's the only explanation I can see. Bertrand Wolff, a novelist I like a lot, who isn't very well known, he says in one of his books, Hollywood is the only place in the world where you have a vicious class war between rival groups of multimillionaires. And it's true, you know. I lived there for a while. I wrote two screenplays. Neither of them ever got produced. But I made money out of them, and they've been published as books, and I make royalties on them every year. Not as much as I make on my other books. People don't like to read scripts.
Now, wasn't that a little bit of a con job?
Well, the first one, yeah, maybe both of them were, come to think of it. This guy told me he was a producer. Actually, he was trying to become a producer. And because everybody he knew was reading my books, he assumed I was much more famous than I am. And having a script by me, he could raise money just like snapping his finger and he could make a movie. But it wasn't that easy. No, most people in Hollywood never heard of me and didn't like my script anyway because it was too damn weird. But it earns me a few thousand every year as a book, so what the hell.
Has anyone ever approached you about actually making it into a film?
No, but I've been optioned about three times on Illuminatus. More than three times. Once on Masks of the Illuminati, and twice on Wilhelm Reich in Hell, which is a play that would very well adapt to a movie. I think it would make a smashing movie. And I have high hopes for that one. It keeps being done as a play all over the country. It's been done in Amsterdam and Frankfurt and England and Dublin and so many cities in the United States, I can't remember half of them. There's a Japanese-American director in San Francisco who put on an excellent production of it at a little theater, and he's now trying to raise the money to put on a bigger production at a bigger theater. Then the next step will be Broadway, you know, if he gets into a big San Francisco theater. Mm-hmm. So I keep encouraging him, yeah, go for it, man, go for it. We're both going for it, you know. He loves the play. And I love him because he loves the play.
What did you think about living in Hollywood?
I didn't live in Hollywood. I lived in West Los Angeles. But I was very much involved with the whole Hollywood crowd for a while there. I met a lot of celebrities, including the head of the Producers Guild, who encouraged me to write an outline for a pilot for a TV series without telling me you usually get paid for that. He said, I'll see if I can sell, so I didn't get paid a damn thing for it. And it never went on the air anyway. But something rather like it showed up 2 years later. Well, just slightly like it. Mine was set on a space colony between the Earth and the Moon. Then along came Babylon 5, which was set in a space colony much further out. But the idea of living in a space colony rather than on a planet face seemed very interesting to me. I think it's probably the future. I don't think we're going to colonize other planets. If you climb out of a gravity well, why climb back down into another gravity well? Well, according to G. Harry Stein, a NASA engineer that I have sometimes appeared on panels with, there are 10 to the 100th power technological processes that can be done cheaper in space than they can be done on a planet face. Eventually, that fact is going to be discovered by the manufacturers of the world. So there'll be a lot of colonies floating around in various parts between planets. Mm. And Gerard O'Neill designed a space colony as far back as 1968. It took him 5 years to get that published, like it took Shea and me 5 years to get Illuminatus published. Gerard O'Neill was a physicist teaching at Princeton. How much prestige can you have? A PhD teaching at Princeton? It took 5 years for any physics magazine to publish his article on how to build a space colony with existing technology. And that came out in 73, and now it's the year 2000, and nobody has done it yet. But there's a Japanese group who are putting a hotel in space, and Virgin Airlines has announced they're going to put up a hotel of their own to rival the Japanese hotel. So things are moving in the direction I sort of foresaw.
When are those due to go up?
Oh, in the next 20 years. I'm not sure of the exact dates.
What about the International Space Station?
Yeah, that's been up a long time, hasn't it? Yeah, but I mean, what I'm thinking of is a real colony. Mm-hmm. First you get the engineers and the technicians, then you got to have sexual partners for them, then there's going to be children, you're going to need teachers, then they're not going to want everything sent up from Earth, so they're going to start their own farms, which is easy to do in space. Gerard O'Neill included that in his plans way back in 68. And eventually they're going to want movie theaters, art museums, and they're going to want lecturers on subjects like neuro-linguistic programming and general semantics and conspiracy theory.
Are you advertising to be sent into space, Bob?
Well, I'm just dropping a hint. If I'm still around when they get the first space colony, I'm ready to do lectures there if they can provide transportation and a good fee.
So why, you mentioned that you left the United States for 7 years, going to Mexico and Ireland. How come you left?
Well, it wasn't consecutive. I went to Mexico, then to California, then to Ireland, then back to California.
Why did you go to Mexico?
Because I was launching a career as a freelance writer, and I figured my savings would last longer in Mexico than they would in the United States. The reason I went to Ireland is because Arlen and I had said over and over to all of our friends, if Ronald Reagan ever gets elected president, we're getting the hell out of this country. We felt rather embarrassed by hanging around. And besides, we both had a romantic thing about Ireland. We're both part Irish. And in both of our cases, we know more about the Irish side of our ancestry than the other side. I know very little about the Austro-Hungarian, Jewish, Greek, etc., South European side of my ancestry. I know a lot about the Irish side. The same with Arlen. She knows a lot about the Irish side and very little about the Scotch and English side. So, except it seems that both of us were descended from Olaf the Black, who was the king of the Isle of Man in the 9th century or sometime around then. He was one of those Viking pirates. He seized the island, announced that he was the king, and then any ship going from Ireland to England or from England to Ireland had to pay him a duty to pass his island. And we both seem to be descended from him, according to a genealogist we met in County Westmeath. So our marriage was incestuous to about the 1/1000th of a degree, or something like that.
Did you enjoy living in Ireland?
Yeah, I enjoyed it more than Ireland did. Ireland is no country for a feminist. The Catholic Church has so much power. She was continually being irritated. I, on the other hand, having grown up Catholic, found it all very amusing. I found it like a rerun of my childhood without being afraid of it anymore, just laughing at it. But she found it irritating. But there was a lot she did like about Ireland, or we wouldn't have stayed there 6 years. And to me, especially Dublin, where we lived, in the vicinity of which we lived and where we went every day at least, well, not every day, but almost every day. Dublin to me is a James Joyce theme park. Anywhere you go, you walk the streets, you go to a restaurant, you go to a pub, you go shopping. Everybody seems to come right out of Ulysses and they all seem to be talking about the same topics. Everything that Joyce mentions is still there. The Wellington Monument, Boylan Department Store on whatever street it is. And living in Dublin to me was like living in the Shire for Tolkien fans, or living in Arkham for H.P. Lovecraft fans. That's one of the things I liked about Los Angeles. I felt I was living in a Raymond Chandler theme park. I'm a big fan of Raymond Chandler.
Do you feel like living in Ireland influenced your writing very heavily?
Yeah, especially, well, Joyce has been a major influence all my life, but I think while I was in Ireland, two of the books I wrote in Ireland are very Swiftian. I've always liked Swift, but I discovered the closest library had almost every damn thing he ever wrote. So I started taking them out one by one and reading all of Jonathan Swift instead of just Gulliver's Travels and The Modest Proposal, which is all most people have ever read. I read the Drapier Letters and The Tale of the Tub and that one with that wonderful title, Thesis that the Abolition of Christianity Would Not Be in All Respects a Good Thing for England. all sorts of wonderful stuff. And I can see a very heavy Swift influence on my book, The New Inquisition, which is a satirical attack on fundamentalist materialism, and also my book, Natural Law, which is a Swiftian sort of polemic against people who believe there are natural laws that can be violated. The Pope said that the other day. He said homosexuality is against natural law. Now, I'm willing, like Randy offers $1 million to anybody who can prove psychic abilities to him, which he can't do because he won't let anybody prove it to him. I'm willing to pay $1 million to see anybody do anything against nature, so anything in violation of the laws of nature. I'm convinced it can't be done. And yet a lot of people say some things are against nature. The atom bomb is perfectly natural or it wouldn't work. I don't like it, but it's natural. Bubonic plague is natural or it wouldn't exist. So I wrote Natural Law to beat the hell out of all the people who use natural law as an argument about how we should behave.
How about the?
They all disagree about what's against natural law. The Pope thinks it's homosexuality. The Ayatollah Khomeini claimed that buggering your brother-in-law was worse than buggering a camel, but buggering a camel wasn't as bad as buggering a weasel or something like that. Well, I don't think he consulted any camels and asked their opinions on that issue, you know.
Did you find that living around the, just in the delightful language of Ireland, seeped into your work at all?
Oh, yeah. Curiously enough, it was while I was living in Ireland, I read this poll. I forget where, I guess I must have read it in the Irish Times. Somebody did a poll of the English-speaking world, and it turned out the Irish have the largest average vocabulary of anybody in the English-speaking world. That's larger than the English, the Canadians, the Australians, and us, and whoever else speaks English. And you notice this, the first thing in Ireland. That's because Celtic culture was so largely oral, and its great classic pagan days. And then after the English conquest, when Henry VIII went Protestant and they tried to wipe out the Catholic Church in Ireland, to try to abolish it totally, they passed a law that Irish parents could not educate their children. They wanted to make them all illiterate. Muhammad the Great used the same tactic when he conquered India. He tried to reduce all the Hindus to illiteracy. And so there was a long period in which the Irish were deliberately starved of education. Then they found out some of the families were sending their children to France to get educated, so they revised the law. It was against the law to educate an Irish child in Ireland or anywhere else. The English really did this. And that contributed a great deal to oral culture, since there wasn't much literacy under those laws, although some did remain. And then there's the fact that nobody has noticed except Anthony Burgess that English and the rest of the English-speaking world has become more and more functional and rational, whereas English in Ireland is ludic, it's playful, it's a game. Hugh Kenner, one of my favorite literary critics, he defines an Irish fact as having the plasticity of a rubber inch. An Irish fact is anything that makes the conversation livelier and inspires somebody to order another pint. Yeah, Kenner went around trying to find out where James Joyce was baptized. He found three churches claiming they baptized Joyce. And this is only recently, you know. When you find out there were seven heads of St. Denis in the Middle Ages, well, what can you expect of the Middle Ages? But this is only in the last century, you know. Joyce was baptized in 1882, right? It's only a little more than a century ago. And well, he met a guy who claimed to know the original of Blazes Boylan in Ulysses. And when Kenner was eager for more details, he told him, well, Bloom finally did confront him. Bloom's real name was Hunter, and he confronted him right here in this park where we're talking. The Irish have much more faith in imagination than in science. which is a relief for me because my mind tends to be rather scientific, although my critics won't admit that. Let's say my mind is both scientific and playful at the same time.
Do you consider yourself to be simply a writer as such?
Well, I used to call myself a guerrilla ontologist, which is a term I picked up from somebody in the physics consciousness research group, which I was a member of back in the 70s. This was a bunch of physicists who got together once a week to discuss the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics. And they had a parapsychologist named Barbara Honegger, and I was invited as sort of resident science fiction writer. And somebody used the word guerrilla ontology for what we were doing. I thought it was a good label, so whenever I was interviewed, people asked me, "What your books are so different, what do you call them?" And I said, "Oh, they're guerrilla ontology." And then I got bored with that after a while, and I found two different books in which I was called a postmodernist. And it was really hip to be a postmodernist in the 80s, so I started calling myself a postmodernist. Then I read some more of the postmodernists and found I disagreed with them on almost everything. So now I just call myself a damned old crank. I think that sums it up better than any of my previous titles.
Who are your favorite writers?
Well, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, and even though it's corny, Shakespeare. Mm. Shakespeare is an inexhaustible well of treasury of language and fascinating characterizations too. I reread something by Shakespeare at least once a year, and I look at Shakespeare films quite frequently. I have a great respect for Homer, but I think I've read the Odyssey about 5 times, but the last time was about 20 years ago, so I guess Homer is sort of fading into the background finally. Moby Dick I've read 4 times, and the last time was only 2 years ago, so Moby Dick is a stronger influence than Homer, I guess. Dante, in spite of all the praise heaped upon him by people I respect, I've never been able to stand much of Dante. I like Chaucer, but I can't claim to be much of a Chaucerian. Raymond Chandler and H.P. Lovecraft are my two favorite of the de classe writers. They're both considered writers of pulp thrillers, not very intellectual and so on. I think they're wonderful. I love their style. I love the way they tell their stories. To me, there's only one detective story writer, and that's Chandler, and there's only one horror story writer, and that's Lovecraft, and all the rest of them are boring, comparatively speaking.
How did you end up getting classified as a science fiction writer?
I don't know.
Because it doesn't really fit.
That fits Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah, true.
The reviewer in New Scientist, which this is one of the greatest reviews I ever got, he said that Schrodinger's cat was obviously written by a committee of nuclear physicists under the pen name Robert Anton Wilson, which he had never heard of before. He said no one quantum physicist could have written it. It had to be a consortium of them. That was the greatest review I ever got. He nobody thought I was a quantum physicist. He thought I was a whole group of quantum physicists. That's definitely science fiction. How Illuminatus got published as science fiction, I don't know. Somebody at Dell had to decide how to package it. I suggested they should just advertise it as the greatest novel since Don Quixote. They didn't take me very seriously. But I think Don Quixote was a major influence, too, by the way. Anyway, they published it as science fiction, and then I wrote Schrodinger's Cat, which was science fiction. Then I wrote Masks of the Illuminati, in which Einstein appears as a character, but it's definitely not science fiction. But by then, my fans were used to looking for me in the science fiction shelf, so that's where all the bookstores put it. Then they started putting my nonfiction in the science fiction shelves, too. And then I heard later they started moving me into the New Age section, which made me want to go and hide in a cave for a few years. And then I got the great news about a year ago that at least in one bookstore, Barnes & Noble in Philadelphia, I have been moved out of New Age into philosophy. So instead of being next to von Daniken, I'm next to Wittgenstein. I couldn't be happier. That's the best news since New Scientist thought I was a consortium of physicists.
What Shakespeare plays are you interested in?
Oh, all of them, but King Lear has always had a special power. I think Shakespeare's use of language definitely reached a peak somewhere around the years of Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, and Othello. And of the whole bunch, I like King Lear the best. I think the language is absolutely staggeringly beautiful in spite of the ugliness of the imagery. It's ugly and beautiful at the same time, powerful. And I like the others I just mentioned, Hamlet, Othello, etc. And I love the history plays. Mm. I even like Henry VI, which everybody considers the least important of the history plays. But if you put the whole thing on in sequence, you start with Richard II and go right through Henry IV, part one and two, Henry V, Henry VI, and then Richard III. You get this panorama. I always compare it to Faulkner's Jognapatoa for County novels. It's like every character seems important and then disappears, a new character, and you know, the thing goes on over a period of 300 years. Faulkner's Jognapatoa for novels only cover about 140 years, but that kind of epic scope I really like, if the writer is good enough. Everything by Faulkner I've read at least twice, and some of them I've read three or four times.
Isn't that the one of the things you're doing in the historical Illuminatus trilogy?
Well, yeah. Well, all of my novels do, if I ever get around to writing the missing volumes, will have a continuous story beginning in 1766 in Naples and ending in the year 20-something, I don't know, in a space colony. Because a lot of the same families, the Babcocks, keep popping up throughout the series. The Chileans keep popping up. The Wildebloods appear now and then. The Moons or Moons keep showing up, and so I got my own world moving in parallel to real history. There's my imaginary history, which keeps interacting with real history. My favorite, by the way, is The Widow's Son, because by the time I finished that, I was absolutely convinced, and I remain persuaded, that nobody, not even me, can tell how much of that is true and how much of it I invented. And I think if you got 10 historians to go over the book line by line, they'd all viciously disagree with one another. That's a technique I learned from H.P. Lovecraft, mixing fact and fiction in a way that gets the reader to wonder, Jesus, maybe even the worst parts of this are true. I learned that from Lovecraft. I gave it a humorous twist in Illuminatus. I give it a sinister twist in some of my other books. But I like keeping the reader uncertain as to how much of this you should believe. That's because I'm not so sure about how much I should believe about what I read in the papers or see on television. I don't believe much of what I read in the papers or see on television. I don't believe much of what I see out my window either, for that matter. I one time shocked the hell out of Bob Shea by saying, I see three or four UFOs a week. And he looked at me like, my God, you have finally gone nuts. And I said, well, what the hell? I've been trained in general semantics for over 40 years. I'm not quick to identify things. Most of the things that go by in the sky are unidentified. As far as I don't know what they are. They could be satellites. They could be airplanes. They could be spaceships. They could be sun dogs. They could be swamp gas. I'm not sure. But for that matter, I see at least 10 UNFOs every week. That's unidentified non-flying objects. Things go by out there. I don't know what the hell they are. I'm just not quick to identify things. I'm uncertain about almost everything, including my own uncertainty. But that comes back to my fascination with Taoism. One text in the Tao Te Ching says, everybody else is full of robust certitude. I alone am tentative. At least that's one translation of the Tao Te Ching. I've read about 20, and they all disagree with one another.
Besides writers, what thinkers do you feel have influenced you the most?
Alfred Korzybski, definitely in first place. I read Korzybski when I was about 18, and then I reread him several times in my 20s when I was first learning to smoke pot. And reading Korzybski on pot is absolutely the best way to read him. Every general semanticist in the country is going to hate me for saying that, but Korzybski's basic thesis is that all perception is co-creation. The brain is the center of our consciousness, but the consciousness is all over the body. He hardly ever uses the word brain. He keeps talking about the nervous system. We are evaluating with our whole nervous system all the time. Our whole organism is involved in the process of creating the environment we think we are perceiving. I'm not saying we're making it up out of whole cloth. We're making it up out of signals we receive, but we make it up to suit our own intents and our own dogmas, if we have dogmas, our own emotion, our own aesthetics even. And everybody lives in a different universe. And reading that on pot, it was easy to understand. A lot of people can't understand Korshevsky, and I always tell them, well, read him while you're stoned, and then you begin to understand. And one of the main things I got from Korshevsky was, I call it neurological relativism. I forget when I coined that term, but it's parallel to Einstein's instrumental relativism. Every nervous system perceives a different universe. And at my workshops, I have various ways of demonstrating this. I have people describe the hall they came through to get into the seminar room, and no two people describe it exactly alike. I've never had a case where two people in the class describe the same hall. Sometimes the differences are quite astonishing. Then I have listening experiments where they all listen. They all hear different sounds, which is partly because they're in different parts of the room, but it's also because we're attuned to different sounds, depending on our life history, our education, and probably our genetics even. And anyway, we're all living in our own worlds that we created, made up out of some common stuff that's common to all of us, so we wouldn't be able to communicate at all. But most of the defects of communication, according to Korshevsky, are caused by the fact we think everybody's living in the same world with us. And when we find out they're not, we think they're either crazy or evil, they're either mad or bad. And learning to accept neurological relativism, I think, is one of the great liberating discoveries of the 20th century. And it's not just in Korshevsky, it's been discovered over and over again under various labels. But Korshevsky put it, I think, in the best terms. And the other thing I got from Korshevsky of tremendous importance, I got many things, but the second one I want to mention right now, the concept of time binding, which is that language allows information to accumulate more and more rapidly as time passes. Now, that's a commonplace thought, but when Korshevsky wrote it in 1933, it was a totally unexpected thought, and he was attacked by the evolutionists for implying there might be such a thing as progress instead of just random chance. But what Korshevsky meant was that due to language, I can receive signals from Confucius. As a matter of fact, I got an edition of Confucius with the Chinese on one page and the English translation on the facing page, and I can read some of the ideograms. I can receive signals from Heraclitus, Plato, etc., etc. And I can receive signals from the latest scientific publications that are online. And so as time passes, more and more information becomes more and more available to more and more people, which means more and more changes in technology, which means more and more changes in society. So I read Korshevsky around 1950, I guess, and the last 50 years have not surprised me at all. I've been expecting rapid changes. In the last year, all the sudden breakthroughs, I've been expecting them all along. I've been expecting we're going to go into space long before anybody else was expecting it. Now the acceleration of information has reached the point where I think it's totally out of control and nobody can stop it. The only way they can stop it is by forming a world government of a totalitarian nature. And the people who most want to control communication are the people who are most afraid of world governments. So they'll never get together to form a world government, so they'll always be. Freedom is increasing all the time because on internet you can publish anything. And if they stop you in one place, you just route it through the Netherlands and it comes right back onto the web in the United States again. And Nietzsche has always been a major influence. Not Zarathustra. The whole Superman thing, I don't care much for. What I like is Nietzsche's later works where he tears philosophy to shreds and destroys all of our ordinary concepts of common sense and the self, the ego, the concrete real world. And
so Beyond Good and Evil and those books?
And Twilight of the Idols and The Antichrist and The Will to Power. And Karl R. Popper was a major influence for a long time. Well, I've read a lot of the philosophers who are trying to make sense out of modern science philosophically, and next to Korshevsky, I would say Popper has had the biggest influence on me. And then there's Benjamin Tucker, who was absolutely the best writer in the individualist anarchist tradition. And even though individualist anarchism sounds rather extreme, most of Tucker's ideas are, well, not most, but let's say about three-quarters of his ideas are pretty much accepted by the Libertarian Party now, and more and more Americans are beginning to sense the world the way Tucker sensed it.
When was he writing?
Well, he did most of his writing between the 1880s and 1914. He appeared for a while in a magazine called The New Free Woman, edited by Harriet Shaw Weaver, who also was publishing James Joyce and Ezra Pound in every issue. And Joyce apparently read Tucker because he told somebody in Paris that Tucker had the clearest head ever in politics. And he seems to have influenced Pound, too, because Pound uses the word usury exactly the way Tucker used it, to describe the manipulation of currency in order to make a profit on the exchange rate.
Isn't that the definition, then?
No, the definition is an excessive charge, an excessive interest charge. That's the current definition. Mm. The Aristotelian definition was any interest charge.
That's what I thought it was, just interest of any kind.
Well, no, in the modern world, because interest is so widespread, they've had a change. It's excessive interest is now called usury. Anyway, Benjamin Tucker, Karl Popper, Alfred Koshybski, Friedrich Nietzsche, and who else? Timothy Leary. How could I leave him out? Timothy Leary, Harry Stack Sullivan, Eric Byrne. Sullivan and Byrne. Sullivan seems like a great predecessor of Leary, and Byrne seems like a great popularizer of Leary without the psychedelics. Leave out the psychedelics, and Byrne is just repeating Leary. What Leary, in his first book called Transactions, Byrne called games, about the same time Leary started calling them games. Wilhelm Reich, which just goes to show the effects of censorship. I was reading a lot of psychology, I always have, but I probably never would have gotten turned on to Reich if the government hadn't burned his books. That got me curious. Who is this man that so terrorized the American government that they were afraid to leave his books in circulation and collected them all and burned them in an incinerator in New York? I went around every place in New York, everybody I knew in New York, trying to find somebody who owned one or two of his books. I found somebody who wouldn't lend them to me. They were too valuable at that point. But I could go to his apartment in the afternoon and read them. And I thought Reich made a great deal of sense. On the psychological and neurological level. I wasn't so sure about the Oregon. Now I found a bibliography of 400 scientific papers confirming Reich's basic Oregon experiments. So I'm beginning to reconsider the Oregon theory, too.
You can buy a lot of Oregon-based products online, too. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah, this bibliography is by James DeMayo, and it has 400 papers by over 100 scientists confirming Reich's basic experiments. And there's been two PhDs granted in Germany for experiments duplicating Reich's Orgone accumulator experiments. And yet the so-called skeptics, as I call them, the people who call themselves skeptics but never doubt their own dogmas, the gang that put out the Skeptical Inquirer, every time they mention Reich, they say his work has never been confirmed. It just goes to show they're so damn dogmatic they don't bother to study a subject before they pontificate on it, or they're fucking liars. I don't know which. I tend to suspect they're so goddamn dogmatic they don't bother examining the evidence for the, and they don't know that there are this many papers confirming Reich. Although they should know, James DeMayo, the guy who did the bibliography, sent them a copy of it. He got a polite note back about why they didn't have room to print that.
I'll bet.
Aleister Crowley has been a major influence.
Well, that's unusual. How has he influenced you?
Well, it started out with Alan Watts. I was having dinner with Alan Watts, and I mentioned the Illuminatus book that Shay and I were writing, and the idea that the eye on the pyramid on the dollar bill is the secret symbol of the Illuminati, which I thought was one of the crazier conspiracy theories. And Alan Watts said, that reminds me, the best book I've read all year is called The Eye and the Triangle. It's a biography of Aleister Crowley. Well, I thought Alan was a pretty bright guy, and if he recommended a book, so I went and read this biography of Crowley, and that got me hooked. I started reading everything I could find by Crowley. Then I started doing his magical exercises, and I started getting results. And I don't think of it in terms of anything supernatural, neither did Crowley. And in his essay, The Psychology of Hashish, he says, thank God I'm an atheist. I think he may have been the first one to have said that. Crowley's magic is a technique for changing your level of consciousness. in various interesting ways, and you can quite easily go totally nuts with his technique if you're not careful. If you are careful, you might survive. Whether I've gone nuts or one of the survivors is a matter about which I cannot speak objectively.
How would you say he influenced you, though?
Well, he combined techniques. He was a kind of eclectic. He started out with the European Rosicrucian tradition. Then he got into the sex magic side of European Rosicrucianism. Then he studied Buddhism in Ceylon with a real Buddhist teacher. Then he went to India and studied yoga there. Then he studied Sufism in North Africa. And then he built up this system which combines several different mystical traditions with a very scientific procedure. You do the exercise, the ritual, the yoga position, whatever, and you make notes on what happens afterwards, and you keep what he called a magical diary. And you see what you're doing to yourself and which direction you're developing in, and if you're developing in a goofy direction, you start doing a different type of exercise. If you know what you're doing, if you have enough common sense to know you're going goofy. Of course, at one stage of doing a lot of Crowley work, I was convinced I was receiving communications from an extraterrestrial, but that didn't last too long. Later, I decided it was my right brain talking to my left brain. Or at least that's what I say when I'm speaking to scientific groups. To me, the metaphors, the explanations don't matter. What matters is the ability to change your consciousness.
Do you still find Crowley cogent for you personally?
Yeah, but there's a lot of infighting in the among Crowleyans, which I don't want to get involved in. So I tend to avoid getting too close to the organized Thelemic movements because they're all denouncing one another currently as frauds. One of them is even claiming another has actually been taken over by Scientology. I don't know what the hell is going on. Paranoia is epidemic in the occult world. I once asked Israel Righardi, who was a psychotherapist.
And also the author of Eye in the Triangle, right?
Yeah, that's right. And he was also Crowley's secretary back in the 20s. I asked him why paranoia is so common among occult circles. He said, well, they activate the forehead chakra before they activate the heart chakra, which any Hindu will tell you is a dangerous thing too. So they start developing strange powers and psychic abilities and weird insights and whatnot, but they haven't opened the heart, so they don't have enough love to deal with this, and it all turns into terrifying demon images which they project on other occultists. I think that makes perfect sense to me. I did a lot of heart chakra work before I did any of the Ajna chakra.
In the Sufi tradition? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. One of my daydreams is to have a convention with Sufis, Subgenii, and A.J. Gold's crowd, and the OTO, the Crowley, the Thelemic group. The Sufi symbol is the heart with wings. Crowley symbol is an empty circle with wings, like the empty circle in Zen Buddhism. And A.J. Gold's symbol is Gurdjieff's enneagram with wings. And the Subgenius symbol is a watch with a knife through it with wings, which represents slack. And Clint Eastwood, I sometimes suspect, is a subgenius because in the Iger Sanction, there's a scene in which he cries with great sincerity, "Give me slack!" And that can't be a coincidence, can it? Or am I putting you on now? And will Clint ever hear this? And what will he think if he does?
So, Bob, you, in your writings, have addressed so many different areas and so many different issues. What do you think unites all your work?
Ezra Pound was asked to contribute to a magazine honoring Wyndham Lewis after his death. And Pound liked to write brief, terse things quite frequently. Sometimes he wrote longer things like the cantos, but he liked to write brief things. And for the Wyndham Lewis Memorial, he wrote, "I still treasure Wyndham Lewis, the man who was wrong about everything except the superiority of live mind to dead mind, for which he should live forever." I'm not sure I got that quote exactly right, but I got it basically right. And that's my basic thing, is live mind versus dead mind. Live, inquiring, curious, uncertain, tentative mind versus dogmatic, closed, frozen, constipated mind. That's what ties all my interests together.
So curiosity.
curiosity, yeah, which allegedly killed a cat once. It hasn't killed me yet. Although some people think it has. Have you heard about the Robert Anton Wilson android?
Isn't that who I'm speaking with now?
Well, some people think so. Back around 94, somebody put a fake news story online, allegedly from the Los Angeles Times, claiming I died of a heart attack. And there was a lot of arguing about whether this was true or it was a hoax. And then people who spoken to me on the phone wrote, I've spoken to Wilson and he is still alive. And then there were the hoax ones that said they contacted me at my home in Hoth Castle. I live near Hoth Castle, but I never lived in Hoth Castle. And I said, I'm not, the reports of my death have been exaggerated. This guy was lifting that from Mark Twain. But then he added a line that really does sound like me. I still totter about a bit and can crack a weak joke now and then. And then somebody else came back with all the people who claimed to have met me or talked to me on the phone. Since my death, they were all deceived. The CIA killed me and replaced me with Robert Anton Wilson android. And having read a lot of Philip K. Dick, I knew if that was true, I'd be the last one to know it because, as Philip Dick pointed out, a fully functioning android would have to believe it was whoever it was supposed to be acting like. So if I was an android pretending to be Robin Anton Wilson, I would think I am Robin Anton Wilson. See, surrounded by epistemological quandaries like that, how can my mental life ever cease? I've always got something to wonder about. I swear to God, I wasn't the one who suggested the CIA. That was somebody else. It sounds like something I might have thought of, but I didn't. I have been responsible for getting into print and online about 20 times now the report that the face on Mars has definitely been identified by computer enhancement of the photographs. And this has been done by Professor Timothy F.X. Finnegan of the Royal Sir Miles Nicholson Astroanomalistic Society in Dalkey, Ireland. And well, it turns out to be Moishe Horowitz, who can now be considered a major influence on two planets. I never give a show business name. I leave readers to figure that out for themselves. Moishe Horowitz was the birth name of Mo Howard of the Three Stooges. And as a matter of fact, if you look at most photographs of the face on Mars, it looks more like Mo Howard than anyone else. Well, at least to me. Somebody actually published a whole book arguing the face on Mars was Elvis Presley. At least I know when I'm joking. I think that guy probably believed his own theory.
Bob, how many kids have you had?
Four.
And one marriage, correct?
That's right, yeah. Well, I didn't need more than one marriage. The first one worked fine. It's still working.
How is that?
I know everything I do. I know what our, not everything, she was a bit unpredictable, all intelligent people are, but and most of the things I do or say or look at on television, I know what her opinion of them would be, so it's like she's still living with me.
You're still having an interaction?
Yeah, we're still interacting. And you don't have to be spiritualistic about it. Our nervous systems imprinted each other over a 42-year period. Mm. So she's still here. I don't feel out of touch with her entirely, somewhat, but not entirely. And she's in most of my dreams. I had a weird dream last night where we were at a party and we were dancing. And there was nothing in the dream to make me think it was odd that she should be alive. In the dream, I forgot she was dead. And I forgot that I'm disabled and can't dance. And we're dancing, and then I noticed that nobody else was dancing. It was all old friends, and they all were walking on canes. And I said to Arlen, you know, we're getting old. We're going to be walking on canes someday ourselves. And then I woke up and realized whether the dream had just reversed reality. George Carlin says, that when people tell me you're getting older, I say, bullshit, I'm getting old, let's face it.
Did you talk to the illustrious Dr. Leary before he passed on?
Yes, and I'd be happy to tell that story. It's one of my favorites of all my Leary anecdotes. I was visiting him as often as I could in the last months. And the last time, everybody knew he only had a few weeks, nobody was sure. And as I left, I said, Timothy, I want to tell you, I've met Buckminster Fuller, and I still think you're the most intelligent man I ever met. I've met George Carlin, and I still think you're the funniest man I ever met. And Timothy, sitting there in his wheelchair, grinned at me and said, "Bob, you're an excellent judge of character." That's my, well, no, I got another favorite Leary. I got 100 favorite Leary stories, but I'll let you off with just one more. A month after his death, I got an email from him. It said, "Dear Robert," he always called me Robert. Everybody else calls me Bob. I don't know why. He always called me Robert. And he insisted that everybody call him Tim instead of Timothy. Anyway, he always called me Robert. And this email said, "Dear Robert, how are you doing? I'm doing fine over here, but it's not what I expected. Too crowded. Love, Timothy." I felt very honored. However he worked that, by whatever process, is spiritualistic or techno or cybernetic, it was a great joke.
If you could wish, I guess, for people to get one thing out of all your work, what would that be?
Well, more open-mindedness, more sense of humor, and more optimism. I don't think there's a single problem facing this planet that can't be solved. I think some of them, the solutions already exist. The problem is implementing the solutions, getting the power elite to recognize that this is in their own best interest, too, to allow some changes to occur. Well, I said it earlier, pessimists don't start computer companies, they don't start anything. Pessimists do nothing but sit around and bitch. Everything is done by the optimists. Besides, somebody named, I think, Barefoot, who may or may not be an American Indian, it may be an old Norwegian name for all I know. So a psychologist named Barefoot published some statistics which seem to indicate that optimists outlive pessimists by an average of 19 years, which encourages me to go on being a blithering optimist in spite of all the voices of... I got one guy in Hawaii really pissed off at me. He kept sending me these doomsday announcements about Y2K, and I kept sending him back the craziest apocalyptical Christian prophecies, which he did not take as seriously as Y2K. He stopped writing to me finally, alas.
So all in all, you're trying to spread a little light?
Well, yeah, spread a little, well, wait a minute, yeah, humor, skepticism, open-mindedness, and optimism. Or as Alan Miller likes to say, he's a psychologist, a good friend of mine, have a little fun, make a little money, do a little good. That's, I think that's as good a life script as anybody can imagine.
This concludes session 1. Our program continues with session 2.